happy to welcome questions and engage you in conversation about these issues.
Thank you, Professor Anderson, Senator Norquist.
Thank you, Chairman Hadley, and thank you, Professor Anderson, for sharing your expertise with us today. The classified system that we have for agricultural property, is that the norm around the country for states?
Well, you ask whether it's the norm. There are explicit classified systems and there are implicit classified systems, right? It's relatively unusual to have an explicit classified system where you just say in the law, we're going to give this class of property different treatment, right? Most state constitutions have uniformity requirements, and so you've got to be careful to be compliant with your state constitution with regard to your uniformity requirement that way. Obviously, our current system conforms with our uniformity requirement. We've had to be careful about that over the years as we've made changes in our property tax system. With regard to personal property, that is machinery and equipment, that sort of thing, rather than real property, land and buildings. But I would also point out that sometimes there are implicit classified systems, that is where the assessors just implicitly value some types of property differently, right? Sure. They just systematically undervalue a particular class of property, maybe agriculture, maybe some other class. I don't advise that kind of thing. That opens you up to all kinds of problems and legal suits as well. So in terms of explicit classified systems, there are others. Massachusetts, when they adopted Proposition 2.5 back in the 70s, right after California adopted Proposition 13, They went to a system that limited the rate of taxation to 2.5% on average, they also introduced a classified system so that they could tax above 2.5% for some classes of property and below that for others. So Massachusetts Proposition 2.5 just means an average tax rate of 2.5%, not a limit of 2.5% on all classes of property. So in Massachusetts, it's possible to tax commercial and industrial properties at a higher rate than residential properties. So it's classified in that way. And there are other state examples as well. But those are the two leading examples I can think of.
When thinking about the percent of how much market value we assess ag property, what factors you think should be taken into account when coming up with that percentage?
I don't know that there's any particular economic insight as to what the percentage ought to be. My tax policy advice would be not to classify, make it 100% assessment for all classes of property, broadens the tax base and allows you to lower rates for all classes of property rather than having high rates for some classes and low rates for other classes. So I'm not a particular advocate of a classified system. If you brought that additional property value onto the tax rolls, then local jurisdictions could have lower rates overall. Now it would affect the distribution of the burden, and that's a subjective kind of question. How heavily do you want to tax agricultural property relative to other classes? There's no particular economic principle that'll tell you one percentage or another.
One last question. On the cap, the idea to cap assessment increases, we certainly have seen historic prices, ag land values, and a rapid increase in that. Are there systems out there that, for example, just for hypothetical discussion purposes, where they would say, historically, we assume land values are going to increase 5%, but we will have a 10% cap. So in years where, prices are going 20, 30% or higher, you would catch up in the long run, but maybe it would ease that increase and spread that increase out over a five-year period as opposed to a 1 or 2 year period.
Yeah, most states, or most assessment practices are smooth to some extent, right? And they use a kind of moving average. As I've reviewed the use value assessments of states, I've seen moving averages that go from 3 to 5 to 8 years. That seems to be the range that states use. I think 8's the highest I've seen. 5 years is the most common that I've seen, and so there's a kind of smoothing, and they use that both in the estimate of the net rent that's generated by the land, so that spikes are smoothed over time, or troughs are smoothed over time, and they use, if you're going to go to a moving average, be careful. I see a lot of use value statutes where the moving average in the numerator for the rent is different from the moving average in the denominator for the discount rate, which doesn't make any sense. All right. If you're going to smooth both sure. consistently over time. So I would caution in that regard. But to the extent that you are treating one class of property differently and providing tax relief there is embedded in that practice higher tax effective tax rates for the other classes of property. That is, for a given level of local public services you want to provide, you're going to be shifting the burden to other taxpayers, other property owners. Thank you.
Senator Hirsch. And I appreciate your testimony here. Is it not true to say that there's something inherently different about the ag land that's owned as opposed to in urban areas, the land that's owned there, the property? Is that why we have perhaps the creation of this dual system of valuation? In other words, in urban areas, such as myself, when my property is for essentially my family's personal use, and we reside in it, whereas that can be contrasted versus in rural areas, the ownership of land, which is primarily then not for personal use or for residing in, but rather more likened or akin to business purposes. A business input of a certain nature. Is that why there's this historical creation of a dual system?
Yeah, and to the extent that our special valuation regulations allow for the homestead to be treated differently from the pure agricultural land around it. Right, so even in our current system where we allow use value assessment in these areas, we do, according to the regulations, the way the special use works, treat the house and a small amount of land. I don't remember if the statute says or the regs say 1 acre around the house is treated differently. So sure. it would be assessed at full market value, and then the ag land would be assessed at current use rather than highest and best use.
So we're talking expressly about land that's used for business, for commercial purposes, then.
One of the things I've noticed in evaluating the 50 states and the way they apply use value assessment is that some of them use, to qualify for this kind of tax treatment, some of them use a de minimis level of income that has to be generated. So you've got to be commercially producing agricultural products to some extent. Some of them don't really have any effective de minimis level, and so you'll get the hobby farmer, so-called, the professional person who lives in town who's got a big acreage and uses it for non-commercial agricultural purposes but wants the use value assessment treatment for the land. This is a contentious issue in use value assessment across the country. And there are egregious examples emailed to me regularly of how this is done. And so you've really got to be careful. Other states will, instead of using a de minimis amount of net income generated, will use a de minimis amount of land. So your 10-acre acreage doesn't qualify. You've got to have at least, half a section or some amount of land that would be a signal that it's more for commercial agricultural than just for personal recreational uses.
Yeah, and I appreciate that answer. With respect to the way we do it in Nebraska with the dual system valuation at essentially 75%, mm-hmm. That's not how neighboring ag states, farm states are comparable to it, right? Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, they're using...
Most of them use use value one way or another.
And so is that use value, is that synonymous or pretty closely correlated to income derived? Or how have when you say use value.
Yeah, so if you go to that simple perpetuity formula, they have some way of estimating the net rent generated by the land, and they capitalize it. So they have some way they measure the income. Now, if it's rented, you know, they've got rules about how to treat rented land or land that's farmed on shares. They've all got ways to estimate that net rent in the numerator, and they all pick a capitalization rate in the denominator. And again, they might use a 3 or 5 year moving average of the net rents per acre, and they might treat cattle land differently from row cropping land. You know, they've got very complex ways in which they measure those. But yes, they have to measure income in some way, net income, for the numerator, and they have to pick a capitalization rate in the denominator. But keep in mind, when we say that Nebraska taxes on the basis of full market value and other states use value, I earlier made the point that outside of urban areas, there's really no difference. There's really very little difference between use value and market value.
So and that's what I wanted to get to. Yeah. Do you think there would be substantial change were the state of Nebraska to change and go to a use or income?
In predominantly rural areas, there'd be virtually no change. Where you would find the change, you know, would be where there's urbanization pressure that drives a difference between market value and use value. Where you've got ag land subject to urbanization pressure, you'll find the difference. And so, but those are the areas where we've currently got special use valuation, and we've got use value there already. So if you're looking to go to use value assessment as some kind of a silver bullet to lower or alter property taxes statewide, I would caution against that, because once you're outside of the major urban areas, market value and use value are nearly the same thing.
One more quick question as a follow-up, and perhaps you don't know the answer to this question, but should, in looking at that, would there be a constitutional problem, if you're aware of it, for the state of Nebraska to effectuate such a change?
I'll have to defer on that. I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah.
I'm an economist.
Senator Milner?
Thank you, Chairman Hadley, and thank you, Dr. Anderson. I want to bring up a brief policy area that you didn't really touch on, and I don't know if we're going to have another presenter talk about it, which is tax increment financing. Can you share your perspective in the sense of whether or not you think tax increment financing is an effective economic development tool, and whether or not the state needs to consider any reforms to our existing statutes regarding TIF?
Well, TIF is another whole ballgame, but it's an issue I followed, and it's an area where I published some of the earliest work on looking at the effectiveness of TIFs. I used Michigan data before I came to Nebraska, and I looked at communities using TIF as compared to those not using TIFs, and in that early study, this is early 1990s, found that communities using TIF financing had subsequently faster rates of growth of their property tax bases, more property value growth. And while I found that statistical association, I couldn't come to the strong conclusion that the reason they had faster economic growth, raising property values, was because of TIF. You know, a cynical view of this might say, well, they saw the economic development coming and they stepped in front of it with the TIF and they captured some of the property value increase for the purposes of the TIF district. And so the question of causality is still a tough one. Now, I've seen more recent evidence done by researchers using especially TIF data around Chicago, where there are hundreds of TIFs, as you might imagine. And that research indicates that while you may get faster economic growth within a TIF when you create it, when you look at the property outside the TIF, that growth may be offset by a decline. So you may be shifting economic activity from non-TIF areas to TIF areas, and you've got to be very careful in doing your analysis to see whether the economic development that's created within TIFs is just being moved from elsewhere
in the urban area. I've seen some evidence by Dick Dye and Dave Merriman at the University of Illinois for Chicago TIFs along these lines, that they find offsetting reductions in economic development outside TIF areas. And so you've got to be careful. It's a powerful financing mechanism, and it's been very useful in that regard. You capture the increase in property value that's due to the TIF activities. You bond against that. It provides a ready financing mechanism that's quite helpful for doing urban development and redevelopment projects. It was originally intended for blighted areas and so on, but a lot of states are allowing it explicitly or implicitly to be used for non-blighted areas as well. The most contentious part of it that I've come across is because in many states, the TIF capture, the property value capture, all the taxes on that capture go to the TIF district in order to pay off the bonds, and it's the school districts that are often the ones that are left out of that process, that don't get any part of that capture. And if the economic development brings more demand for school services, the school districts are often the ones who complain about the way that mechanism works. Some states allow the TIF district to share with the school district, and in that case, it's less contentious. I have no specific recommendations off the top of my head for Nebraska, other than to say I know it's a commonly used financing mechanism. From my point of view in thinking about economic development, it's clear that it does beneficial things in some areas, but you've got to ask yourself whether that's offset elsewhere outside the TIF districts to get an idea of the net benefits that come from that mechanism.
Senator Campbell.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson, are we too reliant on the property tax for funding schools in Nebraska?
Well, it's a good question. Are we too reliant? This is a subjective question, right? I've given you the objective evidence. Okay, so at the local level, we rely on the property tax for about half of our own source general revenue. Is that too high or too low? Well, do you want to be like New Hampshire or do you want to be like Alabama? Take your pick. You want to be higher, or you want to be lower? I think it boils down to the question of, it's the delicate balance between local control at the local level. To what extent do you want to empower local governments to provide services for their community residents? And to what extent do you want the state to play a role in that? And if you say we're too reliant on the property tax, then the implication is, well, you reduce property tax reliance, which is a local own source revenue, and you replace it with what? State income taxes, state sales taxes, and you shift the balance from a local tax to a state tax. If that's what you want, you can move in that direction. So I can't say whether 50% is the right number. I can't say whether that's too high or too low. It is what it is, and it reflects the balance that we have in Nebraska and these competing interests, right? To what extent do you want these services provided by local governments, giving them their own tax bases and their ability to set their own tax rates, or to what extent do you want the state, through its transfer mechanism, somehow to play a greater role? Or do you want to give local governments even more tax bases? Do you want to give them expanded local sales taxes, or do you want to give a local option income tax? The only way to lower property tax reliance is either to spend less on local public services or find other revenue sources. So I know I haven't given you a direct answer, but it's a subjective question. Is it too high or too low? It all depends on this balance that you'd like to strike between the role of local governments and the corresponding role of the state government as well.
We're going to go Senator Harr, then
Senator Hanson and Senator Shields.
Thank you, Chairman Hadley. Thank you, Dr. Anderson, for being here today. I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, I appreciate these charts. I was just wondering, I don't see one here comparing Nebraska to other states as far as property tax per dollar value of the property. And I was wondering if that was intentional, unintentional, and also where we fit within that area, if you know.
I'd love to have a chart like that. The trouble is, it's difficult to come by. It's difficult to come by. What you're asking for is effective tax rates. And this is an area of public finance where effective tax rates are notoriously hard to come by. So it reflects the fact that I don't have the reliable kind of data I would need to generate that chart. It's not for any other reason.
And why is that hard to come by?
But you've got to get valuations nationwide to do that in all 50 states. And because the property tax is administered locally, you'd have to be collecting the data generally from all the local governments in the whole United States. Now, some states collect that up and you can find it at a state level, but not all states do. Some states, like New Hampshire, where it's purely local, you'd have to be going to every local school district in every village in New Hampshire, for example. And that's why it's notoriously difficult for the property tax.
Okay, thank you. And earlier when Senator Mello asked you about TIF, you said one of the concerns was that all we're doing is moving development from non-TIF areas to TIF areas. Isn't that the very purpose of TIF? Insofar as it is much cheaper to develop in a green space, never been developed, than it is to repurpose an area in an urban area that you have to tear down, you might have other compliance issues. And that's the very reason why TIF exists, is because it is more expensive to develop in a TIF area?
Well, I would argue that the reason TIFs target geographic areas is because policymakers have decided that's where they want economic development to occur, and the TIF mechanism helps do that. Now, whether it's more expensive or cheaper depends on the circumstance, right? I've done work for Metro Detroit, if you can believe it, looking at the use of TIF in Metro Detroit. And I've argued in a book I wrote a few years back about Detroit that rather than rebuilding the city of Detroit out in the outer suburbs, it would have been cheaper to redevelop parts of the city of Detroit using TIF mechanisms and others. So it depends on the circumstance. But yes, I mean, you're right in the sense that the TIF mechanism is designed to direct economic activity in particular areas. As I mentioned originally, it was intended to renew blighted areas. That was the policy objective back in the early days. Now, that's morphed to some extent, and policymakers are applying TIF in non-blighted areas, green space,
change the definition of blight.
Yeah, okay. Granted, but the idea is to direct economic development in certain areas, and that has benefits, obviously, that go along with it. I'm just cautioning that in that process, there may be an offset outside the TIF area, and if you want to look at the net benefit that comes from TIFing, you better offset what happens outside the TIF district as well, because that has that gives you the fuller picture about the benefit of your TIF.
Okay,
that's fair. Senator Hanson.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson, it's good to hear you today. I've got a couple of questions. First one, I guess, on the sheet here, we do have another adjoining state, and it's Wyoming.
And
so who paid, and they have a higher per capita property tax than Nebraska, yet people walk, their money and the people walk toward Wyoming away from property tax. And so who pays property tax
in Wyoming? Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, when you think about the property tax, it's not only residential property owners and agricultural property owners, it's commercial and industrial and so on. Wyoming is different in my mind because they generate a lot of tax revenue from severance taxes, from all the coal that's mined there. And so as you think about Wyoming, yes, it should be a green bar as well. the distribution of local property tax burdens across classes of property there, I'm not aware of off the top of my head, but I suspect you've got mining interests and other interests that are paying substantial taxes.
High-income retirees around the, in the western part of the state, bottom line, Wyoming, because of the lack of property tax on residential.
Yeah, but
on
a per capita basis, you see that it's slightly above Nebraska. So on a per person basis, as a share of income, just slightly below. Their reliance on the property tax at the local level is substantially below Nebraska's. Instead of our roughly 51%, they're down in the mid to high 30s. So they're less reliant on the property tax at the local level than we are. And my suspicion is the severance tax revenue and the way that plays an important role in their fiscal picture is what's behind that.
I would certainly agree. One of your last statements, before you opened up the question about the market value and the use value, is the same when you get out of the chattel of the urban areas. I would really, really question that. And the reason is these specialized sales, Hamilton County, York County, all up and down the Platte River Valley, along the interstate, I think they're more widespread than that. You get a sale and you get $1 million in a quarter of a pivot. That'll never pay for itself. So that's beyond the use value, yet people are willing to pay for that. Sand Hill's value is the same thing. People are willing to pay $600 an acre, which it will never pay for itself. Mm-hmm. It's either neighbors or someone coming in out of the state to have those ranchettes, or a ranchette out there on five sections. So it's a little different. But I can't quite think that the market value of what it sells for is the same as its use value just because it's out of the urban area.
Well, that's what my evidence, my statistical evidence indicates around Lincoln and Omaha. And I know there are peculiarities when you go out along major rivers.
Third district, if you look at a map of the third district. Then
But
and what it affects the school districts. And Senator Sullivan, I'm sure, is worried about these high sales too, because that ag bubble is going to burst someday, and that valuations that we spend a lot of tax money, a lot of property tax money, running the schools. And that,
bubble's
going to burst on it.
Yeah, I can't speculate on whether there is a bubble or...
Tell me when, I appreciate it.
Yeah, okay. I won't tell you to buy a Powerball ticket for Saturday's drawing either.
Charles? Thank you, Chairman Hadley. Professor, thanks for coming in today. And I just want to make sure that I'm thinking on the same page as what you're talking about. And I figured this back to the effective rate of the property tax that's being paid and as it applies to certain classifications of businesses.
Yeah.
So you've got a commercial business in town that owns property that's selling a product or selling a service or something like that that's paying that property tax compared to and contrasted with an ag property that's out there that's providing income for that. Should we be looking at the differences in how that income is derived? And what I mean by that is folks on the farm that are growing crops, raising livestock, things such as that, they're price takers. They don't get to put their price on a wall and say, hey, if you want it, this is what you have to pay. It's the other way around. Businesses in town, they can hang whatever price tag they want to on their product. And whether they get paid or not, they have some ability to make that tax up.
Yeah.
How should we look at that as we go forward?
Well, that was the purpose for the three slides on the three different ways to think about the incidence of the property tax. And the nuanced way to think about that, using the capital tax view, which I ended with, is that the capital owners bear the burden of the overall average rate.
But do some bear more than others? Because of their ability to either pass that price on or
well,
not.
Of course, yes, yeah. Your ability, the market circumstances in which you operate determine how much you actually bear.
And your ability to either pass the tax back to your input suppliers or pass it forward to your customers determines what you get stuck with bearing. And that depends on the type of industry you're in. And your characterization of agriculture is the conventional wisdom, right? They operate in competitive product markets and competitive input markets, and so they've got a limited ability to pass the tax to anybody else. Okay. Now, whether a commercial enterprise in Omaha has a superior ability to pass that tax on to customers or back to input suppliers depends on the market circumstances there as well. And so I don't have any general characterization of that, but your point is right that the market circumstances ultimately determines who bears the burden of that tax.
And then beyond that, if you look at that, then you have to start to take into account that there's nuances as you look at some of these different models that you showed up there, how they work within each other. Mm-hmm. Because those folks maybe that are in a more urban area that are able to pass their costs along, maybe not in this location, but maybe in a different location, now all of a sudden have that ability to vote with their feet and move where they need to move to get that, so that they can either not have to pass it on or find somebody that's willing to pay more to get that.
Yeah. But a property tax system based on market values is saying, let's let market signals about the value of this property inform us about how valuable this property is, whether it's agriculture or commercial or industrial, and let's take our cues from the market circumstances that determine the ability to earn, you know, net income and what makes that property valuable. So a property tax properly conformed, in my view, is based on market values and takes its cues from all the market circumstances involved.